Good morning. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, we'll hear about a forum on a possible coronavirus vaccine. It took place virtually this week at CU Boulder. Then a new report has found that women in Colorado will lose an average of $322,000 over the course of their lifetimes, and that's likely more for women of colour. We'll hear why and what can be done. Monday is Indigenous Peoples Day. We'll hear some of the sounds and voices from last year's celebration, and we'll hear what lies ahead for this year. Two regular Friday morning features, a food waste tip from John Lendorf and the latest Trends Diary. At the bottom of the hour, it's time for Connections, and today Duncan Campbell is joined by Lisa Graves, Senior Fellow and former Executive Director of the Centre for Media and Democracy. But first, the latest local headlines. There's a new outbreak of the coronavirus at the immigration detention facility in Aurora. Steve Miller has more.
Aurora's Immigration and Customs Enforcement Facility is confirming that cases of COVID-19 have about doubled this month among detainees. The Sentinel reports that as of Tuesday, ICE has 37 confirmed cases among detained immigrants. That's up from 21 cases counted in a September 30th report. The office of Aurora Congressman Jason Crow originally reported GEO Group Incorporated, which runs the ICE facility, had ruled out the possibility that someone transferred into the facility brought COVID-19. Congressman Crow said he is left wondering how it got there. Alethea Smock, a regional spokesperson for ICE, said that the count only pertains to detainees and did not say if the outbreak includes agency or GEO staff. Colorado People's Alliance, an immigrant justice group based in Aurora, condemned the outbreak Thursday and are calling for the release of all immigrants detained in the facility. COPA organizer Raul Medina said that one detainee stated that they were moved into a pod with sick people and denied disinfectant to clean the area. People became sick several days later. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
Mandatory evacuations were issued early this morning for parts of Larimer County as a result of growth in the Cameron Peak fire. Residents and businesses in Pingree Park and Monument Gulch were ordered to evacuate just before 6 a.m. today because immediate and imminent danger. Fire officials say to evacuate the area immediately and as quickly as possible and to not take time to gather belongings or to protect homes and businesses. The Cameron Peak fire began in mid-August and it's now burning more than 131,000 acres. It's 44% contained. Students in the Boulder Valley School District will return to in-person school sooner than anticipated. The Daily Camera reports that at the school board meeting last night, the district superintendent announced the new timeline for students to return to classes in person. Third through fifth grade, sixth grade and ninth grade students will now be back in person on October 20th. The rest of the middle and high school students can attend in person starting October 27th. Elementary students are in person 4 days a week, middle schoolers 2 days a week, and high schoolers 1 day a week, with remote learning happening the other days. K through second grade students returned 4 days a week to in-person classes on September 29th. Families will also continue to have the option to keep their children remote learning also. Public health officials from Broomfield and Boulder County presented updated data at last night's meeting showing that new cases of the coronavirus are significantly down at CU Boulder. Both health departments supported the district's current plan. In the weather today, smoky skies again, highs in the low 80s, and tomorrow similar temperatures and conditions with smoke lingering for the coming days around the metro area. Temperatures will drop slightly on Sunday with highs in the mid to low 70s. Russia and China have fast-tracked COVID-19 vaccines and are requiring them on a mass scale and far too soon, according to many experts, to assure that the vaccines are safe and effective. Meanwhile, President Trump has stated that the US will have a COVID-19 vaccine ready by November. The Trump administration's pressure to fast-track a COVID-19 vaccine got so intense in August that Reuters reported a top US vaccine regulator vowed to resign if the Trump administration approved a vaccine before it is shown to be safe and effective. Well, that top regulator, who threatened to resign, is still at the FDA. And this week, the White House approved an FDA plan to assure the COVID vaccine will be safe and effective. The plan does not require a vaccine to be ready in time for the elections. Well, the top vaccine regulator who pushed for vaccine safety and effectiveness is Peter Marks. Marks directs the Food and Drug Administration's Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research, which includes vaccine research. Well, this week, Dr. Marks spoke with students at CU Boulder who had many questions, including whether or not a COVID vaccine will be recommended or required for people who work in hospitals or people who fly on planes and in other situations. The students also asked about how to determine when a COVID vaccine is ready for a shot at being available to the public. Here are excerpts from a question and answer Zoom seminar that CU Boulder's Programme for Writing and Rhetoric conducted with Dr. Marks of the FDA.
We're going to do everything in our power at FDA to make sure that we have a process that's transparent so that people see that we really care, that what we put out in terms of an approval is based on the scientific data, that a vaccine truly is safe and effective and a quality product, that it's a vaccine that we feel comfortable using on ourselves, our families, and our friends. And hopefully they'll see this, that we'll have confidence in that small microcosm will build out to the macrocosm. But more importantly, my guess is there will be areas of the country that will be early adopters of a vaccine with higher vaccine coverage and some that might be later adopters. And those that get to a place where they are actually able to go back into restaurants again, go bowling, go to the movies because they have such slow COVID rates, probably people will then emulate those because nothing will bring this back more than the vision of success, particularly if that success is not associated with any significant number of adverse events of concern with a good track record for a vaccine. So I think the first uptake, it's going to be that we've done our job as public health agencies, that we've helped restore trust, which I cannot deny has been eroded in vaccines, but we do what we can to help restore trust. Hopefully, once the vaccine is deployed, the proof is in the pudding. People will see it in action and we'll see what it can do.
How does the FDA timeline for vaccine approval differ from the White House timeline?
You know, I'm going to try to finesse this without getting myself into jail. So let's say this. I think there's optimistic timelines here of when you could have a vaccine. Given the large trials that are ongoing, is it possible that one of these trials reach its interim endpoint in late in October? It's possible. It's more likely that one's going to reach its interim endpoint sometime in November or December. I'm very much in line with something that Dr. Fauci said last night on CNN, which is that, yeah, it's not unlikely that we'll see something submitted probably before the end of the calendar year in terms of an emergency use authorization request from the agency. I don't know that for sure, but it's a reasonable probability. So we'll just have to see what happens there. You know, a lot of people can opine on this, but we'll just have to see where it comes in. At FDA, we're just going to remain ready because when it comes in, we are committed to a very transparent process, making sure that any vaccine that comes in, not only will we do our work, but we'll also bring it to a public advisory committee meeting where an independent group of academics who have been vetted for conflict of interest will discuss the vaccine. It'll be in a public setting. People will be able to watch it and will be able to hear what they have to say. Public can even comment at the meeting and will be able to hear what they say about the vaccine. So we're ready to do that whenever it comes. And so I'm hoping sooner rather than later for something that's really safe and effective, because the sooner we can all move past this, the sooner we'll have, you know, people getting back to lives and livelihoods. We haven't touched on the social and economic costs of COVID-19, which are quite considerable.
Speaking of the vaccine, if a person can provide evidence of a positive antibody or PCR test, will they be able to waive a work or travel requirement for the vaccine?
Great question. And I suspect that's going to be one that the Centers for Disease Control will probably have an answer for. But I can tell you there's a lot of talk in the global community of having something like an iPhone app where you'll either be able to be documented as vaccinated or known to be immune by some method. So I can't say that that's American policy, but I can say that that's what's being thought of on a global basis. It seems to make a lot of sense to me, but we'll see where that goes.
You've been listening to Dr. Peter Marks. He directs the FDA programs that will decide just what COVID-19 vaccines to approve and when to approve them. Marks spoke earlier this week on a question and answer Zoom seminar for CU Boulder. And we'll share more of that vaccine discussion with Peter Marks in the weeks ahead on KGNU's Tuesday morning science show, How on Earth. Thanks to Shelley Schlender for that report. Well, Monday is Indigenous Peoples Day, and there are several events happening in Boulder over the weekend to celebrate. Here are some sounds from last year's celebration.
Hello, my name is Dwight White Buffalo. I'm a member of the Southern Cheyenne Tribe of Oklahoma, now part Lakota, South Dakota. And fancy dance, I've been doing that since I was 9, so going on close to 41 years. And it's more of a war dance, and it's more like when we go out to war, then we'll have a war dance before and after to get us prepped up for the journey. And when we get back from, could be for hunting or perhaps counting coup on an enemy, you know, come back, then we'll have a war dance.
Why is it so symbolic to do this today in Indigenous Day in Boulder, in the land of the Arapaho?
Because it's part of our culture, and we've been doing it for many generations that I can remember, and it's been passed down for many generations.
Sounds from last year's Indigenous Peoples Day celebrations. Well, this weekend there are several events happening. This evening from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. there's a screening of the film Confluence, followed by a discussion with award-winning filmmaker Gwendolyn Cates and Indigenous and Black activists who will explore intersectionality and solidarity of the Black Lives Matter and Indigenous rights movements. Tomorrow at noon, there's a community conversation, Some Dance to Remember, Some Dance to Forget, with placemaker Meg Walker and public artist Maury Bean, who'll talk about the meaning of the memorials like the Civil War Monument at the Boulder County Courthouse. And on Sunday, from 10 a.m. to noon, supporting Native artists and dancers in need. This virtual event involves a collaboration with Native artists who will create regalia for Native children that cannot afford to make or purchase their own. Also on Sunday, from 1 to 3 p.m., the American Indian Youth Leadership Institute Forum. You can meet and network with young leaders and discuss ideas to support community members during the COVID-19 pandemic. You can find more of the Indigenous Peoples Day events at bouldercolorado.gov. Do a search for Indigenous Peoples Day 2020. A new report called The Cost of Failing to Invest in Women. When we invest in women, we all win. Found that women in Colorado will lose an average of $322,000 over the course of their lifetimes, and that figure is likely more for women of color. Well, the report was done by the Colorado Center on Law and Policy for the Women's Foundation of Colorado. Christina Yabua, who's the health research and policy analyst at the CCLP, told KGNU's Rosanna Longo that the failure to address the gender income gap, specifically for women of colour, will affect the economy nationally and statewide.
We had been working on this project starting January, so pre-COVID coming to the United States, we had started looking at this, and we ended up having to kind of amend a little bit about how we were doing the research and make sure that we were including COVID. And what we found was that women tend to fare worse in disasters and pandemics. So we started to look at things like Hurricane Katrina and other tragedies. And what we saw is that they tend to lack access to resources more so than men. They tend to be more likely stranded in natural disasters more so than men. There's an uptick of gender-based violence that happened for women. And then also there's the impediments to careers, right? So like all the school closures that are happening, a lot of women are the primary caretakers for their kids. And so thus they're having this really hard time continuing to do the work that they need to do for their careers while still now having to play stay at home mom and to help their kids in their online learning. And then also, you know, women are more likely to be healthcare workers. So they've really been on the front lines of a lot of this work at COVID. And so we really have to take a look into how women were faring in COVID-19 and see what the economic kind of repercussions of COVID were going to be for women specifically.
That's really interesting. Were there any statistics that were shocking in this report?
You know, we all talk about the income gap, right? Typically, from what I've heard, people usually cite somewhere around like 76 cents to a dollar. For every dollar that a man makes, a woman makes 76 cents, right? So in the state of Colorado, for every dollar made by a man, women get paid 86 cents. And that's when we break it down by race, that's when it really becomes more egregious, right? So Black women are paid 63 cents to every dollar. Native American women are paid 56 cents, and Latinas are just 54 cents. And so I thought that was terrifying to me. There's a group of women that are making nearly half. And, you know, one of the things that is often brought up as an argument against the income gap is educational attainment, right? That women simply don't have the access to education. And that's one of the things that contributes to that issue of the income disparity. But what we're finding is that 86 cents figure actually ends up dropping down to 74%. So even when you account for the educational attainment, assuming that everyone has a bachelor's degree, the disparity between men and women actually widens with more education. And that was really shocking to me.
Widens with more education. That is really strange, don't you think? It's like backwards. It's almost like we encourage our daughters to study, to go to school. And even if they get the bachelor's, the master's or the PhD, they are still going to get paid less?
Absolutely. And so one of the things that we really wanted to have as a major takeaway from this report was that we need to be investing specifically in women, right? Like we need to have some very intentional policy measures and business measures in place that are really encouraging the investment into women, because without us having an equality in income and an equality in access to resources, it actually takes a huge toll on our economy as a whole.
How did you go about crafting the solutions included near the end of the report?
Colorado Center on Law and Policy, for listeners who are unfamiliar with us, we're an anti-poverty advocacy organization. So we do everything ranging from kind of legislative advocacy to administrative advocacy. We do litigation and research, all in work to try to fight poverty and kind of the systems that put people in poverty and promote that cycle of poverty. And so we really heavily relied upon the expertise within our organization and within Women's Foundation to kind of make sure that whatever we're talking about leads to system level change. So we're really excited about being able to do this kind of research so that it can in turn inform our advocacy strategy and our agendas. And we can be encouraging the decision makers that are within our sphere of influence to make sure that we're taking into account women and women's financial security.
So you identified as a woman of color.
I'm a Black woman.
And how did this identity that you hold influence how you see this report?
As a Black woman, I really understand this kind of concept that In the equity space, people call it intersectionality, which just simply means like when you hold, you know, various identities, the touch point of those identities end up leading to like a synergy of different types of oppression, right? And so like as a Black woman, I'm discriminated as a Black person and as a woman and as a Black woman. And so what we wanted to make sure that we were doing, and I really appreciate the Women's Foundation being so willing to make sure that this is included in the report, is to make sure that when we're disaggregating data, that we're disaggregating it by both gender and race. So we're not just looking at women as a whole, that we're making sure that we look at what kind of disparities exist for, you know, Indigenous women, for Black women, for Latina women, and seeing the differences between those. I think that that's really important because a lot of times when we're trying to develop solutions for gender-based disparities, we kind of develop some kind of blanket solution, and then we don't look at the different solutions that could be used for the various identities within this community. And women are not a monolith. They have lots of situations that intersect with their identities, and it's important that we're really looking and considering into all of those situations and making solutions that are comprehensive for all people.
And especially solutions that come from that sector that is the most affected.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So yes, because that's what is incredible about the report, that it has also that lens of equity. What is it that you would like people to know, especially at this moment of crisis that we're going through?
There's a few takeaways that I'd like folks reading this report to take away. The first of which, one of the things that we really try to do is to make this real for people who are seemingly unaffected, right? So as a man or as a white woman or, you know, as an identity that not necessarily is centered within this report, we want to make sure that you understand that investing in women isn't just about, you know, the moral of ethics of it. It's also an economic statement. So, you know, just a few numbers to point out. Globally, the loss in human capital due to gender inequality is estimated to be about $160.2 trillion. And a country loses somewhere between $15 trillion to $30 trillion in lost lifetime productivity and earnings because of the limited opportunities for girls and barriers to obstructing women to complete their education. And we also find things like businesses with female CFOs are more profitable and have superior stock prices. So this isn't just about a moral and ethics thing. This is about this is an economic decision. Also, you know, when we're thinking about the policy levers in place, you know, we, like I said before, we want to make sure that decision makers know to factor in women into their decisions. So when we're thinking about workspaces, the decision makers in various workspaces to make sure that they're thinking about their affordable childcare and their leave policies and making sure those are equitable. When we're thinking about people who have influence in healthcare, thinking about what are ways that we can make sure that women have all the access to reproductive care, especially during the time of COVID-19, when it feels a little less accessible, and to maternal care, how can we increase insurance coverage for women and women of color specifically? You know, what can we be doing to promote women's businesses? And then for our, you know, fellow researchers, we have to make sure that we are disaggregating all of our data by both gender and by race to make sure that we're kind of getting a whole picture of something and not just getting one number as if communities are monolithic. Disaggregating data is super important for our fellow researchers.
I have been speaking with Christina Yebula. She is Health Research and Policy Analyst from Colorado Center on Law and Policy, and we have been talking about the cost of failing of investing in women. For KGNU, I am Rosanna Longo.
Time now for another food waste tip from John Lendorf.
Hi, it's John Lendorf from KGNU's Radio Nibbles, here with another practical way to cut food waste, save flavor, and save some money.
For instance, our landfills are full of still edible vegetables that we toss away. Instead, try this. If you bought too much of a particular veggie, chop it and freeze it for later. You can cook it first, and then it's ready to be added to a dish. You can peel broccoli and cauliflower stalks. They can be spiralized, steamed, sautéed, or shredded for slaw. If you scrape the kernels off of corn cobs, you can then simmer the corn cobs to make corn broth you can use to make cornbread or chowder. Save your vegetable trimmings and peelings, outer leaves, stems, and tops to make broth that adds flavor and nutrition to soups, stews, and sauces. You can freeze the broth in ice cube trays to make it easy to use later. Many vegetables, such as slightly wilted carrots, cucumbers, broccoli, radishes, that kind of thing, can be cut in small pieces and simmered briefly in pickling liquid for quick pickles that'll last in the fridge for a long time. You can even use leftover store-bought pickle juice. If you use a juicer, save the sweet pulp that can be used to make quick, fiber-rich breads, and the green tops from carrots, radishes, beets, and celery, and that kind of thing. Don't throw those away. They can be pureed and used to make pesto with roasted pumpkin and winter squash seeds that can be scraped out, salted, oiled, and roasted. Remember, composting is a last resort, and you can find all of these tips and other food waste information at news.kgnu.org.
Up next, it's Trends Diary.
Time now for Trends Diary, where Boulder County residents of all ages share personal experiences that relate to a pressing community need. The focus for now is on our shared need to connect and solve problems, despite the increased isolation we're all experiencing during the COVID-19 pandemic. This project is brought to you in partnership with Community Foundation, Boulder County.
Dear Trends Diary, my name is Will Betke Brunswick. I make comics. I was on the City of Boulder's website, I don't even remember why, and I saw that there was this fund for artists in Boulder who had work canceled, the COVID work projects. I was supposed to be doing 3 shows this spring, Denver Zine Fest, Denver Small Press Fest, and Vancouver Comic Arts Festival. All of those were canceled or postponed. I created a comic diary that spanned a month during stay-at-home orders. I made a zine of moments from quarantine in my neighborhood, about my garden, about taking walks, very everyday sort of things. But every day in quarantine, which added an edge of anxiety and uncertainty, but also humor. I mailed them to 20 of my closest neighbors. I didn't know if I'd ever hear from them. One reached out through my Instagram, another when I was walking my dog. That was more than I was hoping. I'm a little bit shy, so I don't usually talk to my neighbors. The process of making it was like the first step in giving me some confidence as a way to reach out to my neighbors. Otherwise, I don't know what I would say to them. I've started to say hello a little bit more. The zine sort of gave me a starting point. It helped me connect to them. I'm hoping it connected other people. My goal for doing this was to share art and bring some humor and lightness and connectedness around something very specific, our neighborhood, and something we were all experiencing. Even if the person reading it is the exact opposite of me in every way, they're still in this neighborhood. The cover is the street sign of 13th. Every person has walked past that sign. Since this piece came out, I'm now a Trends Reporting Fellow. You can find more of my work on Instagram at Transboy Comics or on my website, willbetkebrunswick.com.
Feeling inspired? Do you have your own story of making connections or solving problems during this time of physical isolation? Then visit www.commfound.org. Look for Trends Diary and share your experience with Community Foundation Boulder County. Your submission could wind up on these KGNU airwaves.
Thanks for tuning in to The Morning Magazine here at listener-supported KGNU.